Hi, it's DGAF. And this is season 4 of Sessions. Let's get it this year. Let's save the princess, right? Feliz Navidad, sound guy. You look good in that Santa hat, man. I wish it wasn't the only thing you were wearing, though. What'd you get Cinny this year? Oh, gross. What? We're on? Okay. Sessions, Christmas special with Berkey. I interviewed longtime poker acquaintance Matt Berkey in season 3 of Sessions. Over the course of 2 hours, I got Matt's inspiring life story. We reminisced about the days we used to battle in Las Vegas. We talked about his poker rock bottom. I was at the table for it. And we covered his ascension to the poker stratosphere. If you want to hear that interview, I have made it public for the rest of the year. If I recall correctly, Matt showed up on Zoom 10 or 15 minutes after I hit record, so be prepared for some impromptu spew from me at the start of it. I interviewed Matt Berkey again yesterday on Christmas Eve 2021. We talked about his recent appearance on Hustler Casino Live, playing nosebleed no limit hold'em against several legends of the game for 2 days straight, and he won the most money and arguably played the best. Then we talked training sites for a little bit before turning the clock back to a time when Matt wore a younger man's clothes. Solve for Why wasn't even an idea yet. He was all but broke, still clinging to his childhood dream of becoming a professional baseball player. And then, one day, he walked in to Paradise Casino in Yuma, Arizona.
What a day. Sorry.
What, no worries, man. What's going on? What have you been doing on this Christmas Eve?
Work, man. A lot of work.
Me too. I saw that in our messages. I was kind of happy to know that someone else was grinding on this day. What have you been doing? You said you were finishing a video. What does that mean?
Well, you know, much like yourself, I am forever the procrastinator. So I had a due date yesterday for my editors to get my training videos in that are due or that will like launch early January. And I didn't quite finish. I was up to like 3, almost finished, just had to like go through. So it's like scripted shit.
Right.
I just had to like record and read. But then yeah. I found like problems because obviously I was working at like 3 a.m.
Of course. And
I'm like trying to get it done, but also like trying to do it right. And it just ended up taking like twice as long.
That's cool. How do you know I'm a procrastinator?
Because I see your tweets, man.
Oh.
I see you trying to fire out like 5 podcasts the day before the due date.
Yeah, I don't know if I'm a procrastinator or if I just suck at time management. One of the two. But I'm glad to have you on. So I wanted to ask you about Hustler Casino Live first, because a lot of people saw you go on that show when Durr and Ivy and Garrett and Gall and everyone else was there. And I believe it was your best performance on stream, at least that I've seen. Is that accurate?
I may have had a bigger winning, like a bigger singular winning session on either the bike or Poker After Dark. But yeah, I mean, as far as like back-to-back streams go, that was definitely like the best I've done.
I think I'm just so used to seeing you run like death on those shows and then everyone just flame you everywhere they can. It was nice. It was a nice change. What were you guys playing?
Mostly 200, 400. The first day it got shorthanded. It was me, Gall, Garrett, and a little bit of Krish. He ended up bowing out pretty quickly. And we were just playing 4-8 at that point.
4-8. Okay, so you guys are playing big. Not your biggest win ever on stream, but it was a it was probably 12 hours total in play?
Maybe a little bit longer. Well, it's tough to gauge because we waited for Ivy both days.
Right.
which is silly because he just quit early anyway.
Right.
But yeah, I think the streams were about 6 hours each, give or take.
Okay. Were you, it seemed, I didn't watch all of it, but I watched some of it, but it seemed like you were very locked in. Just, were you just having like a good weekend, or are you just always locked in these days, or is that even accurate?
I mean, the thing of it is that like, these are tiny little snippets of like a much, much, much larger sample of poker, right? And I think the reason why live streams garner so much criticism or praise for particular players is based off of like how much variance is built into their strategy. And you know, you're like me, you get it, man. We like to play a lot of the hands. And ironically, Garrett is kind of the same. The difference is that you get to see him 3-4 times a week, every week, all year long. So he's probably played, you know, maybe 5 or 10x as many hours on stream as I have. And what becomes of this is that when you have, like for me, that weekend felt like paint drying. I was just dealt good hands occasionally, and then mostly really, really, really shitty hands. And it just, you know, it looks like great strategy on the surface because it's just fucking nitty. But I wasn't consciously being nitty. I just like, you know, people were like, oh, this is the tightest Berkey's ever played. He's playing so great. Like he's finally made the adjustment. He's not a spew anymore. It's like, nah, man, I just wasn't dealt 10-8 suited ever.
Right. Yeah, I get that. I'm probably the biggest variance truther out there. But also, I don't think it's you're playing nitty or you're playing wide open. I think you probably just play poker. And you play hands that make sense to play in certain situations against certain opponents. And you fold the ones that don't make sense to play. And you just were kind of dealt pretty easy decisions pre-flop is what it sounds like.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Mickey was B-pipping every hand and he was to my left. So like I had every opportunity in the world to just enter pots with him. We played one hand together. Right. And that wasn't a byproduct of like me trying to duck the guy or him trying to duck me. It's just like, you know, you get dealt a lot of like offsuit trash for 6 hours. That's not that unheard of.
Yeah. I watched part of it. I watched, you were in a pretty tough spot. I want to say you slow played jacks to some extent pre-flop. And Gall went for it, not repping a ton, but putting a ton out there. Do you mind walking us through that hand history if you remember it?
Yeah, sure. So at this point, we were four-handed, playing 400, 800. Krish folded the cutoff, aka under the gun. Garrett opened the button, Gall 3-bet. And the thing to note at this point was Gall was buried. He had lost a bunch to Mickey and some to Krish as well. And he was, I mean, Garrett was like his usual active self. And Gall was matching that and then some from his spots. So he showed up in like some 3 and 4 bet pots with like offsuit connectors, like 7-6 off and shit like that, where it's just clear he's abandoned all construction at this point. He elects the 3-bet from the 400. I have jacks in the 800 and I 4-bet to like 20K. Garrett folds, Gall calls, and the flop came 8, I think 6-7 was a straight. So 8-4-5, I believe, with 2 spades, and I had the jack of spades. He checks, and I think in general, people's mindset in this spot is that I have good hand, it can get sucked out on, let's put money in the pot type of thing.
Yeah.
But you know, I think that that's a very simplistic mindset where you're accustomed to a very static opponent who does exactly what you expect him to do according to the theory. And more importantly, you're not deep. We were like 500 big blinds effective here. Mm. So it's just like your ability to stack off with one pair in this pot is non-existent. Like it's if I just get it in with jacks on this board, I just get absolutely torched by everybody because it's just, you're just going to get shown 6-7, you know?
It's fucking nice. If you get it in with jacks on, what was it? 8-5-4-2 spades.
Yeah.
You're sometimes like okay and often in a lot of trouble. You right. guys were sitting 400K deep?
Slightly less maybe.
Okay, but still deep.
Yeah, either that or this hand was 2-4, but I just recall that it was like we were very deep. We were like 3 to 500 big blinds effective.
Okay. And so you check back, it sounds like.
Yeah, so it's like you know, this may be a pure bet whenever you're 100 blinds effective or the SPR is like sub 10. But it's not. It's very deep, and your stack off threshold is incredibly high. So, like, you're not really betting a ton here. And Jacks with the Jack of Spades is just kind of like a nice two-street hand that we can kind of mitigate the pot, leverage our position with. We're not afraid of too many runouts. Like, spades aren't that big of a deal. We have one. That type of thing. So, yeah, I thought it was like a pretty good – I thought it was a cool spot, let's put it that way, to have overpairs in a checkback range that aren't just aces.
Okay, and so you check back. Gall, you mentioned the game flow. Gall is buried and going for it, it sounds like.
Yeah.
Okay, does that plays in your decision a little of more than a little bit to check
back? Yeah, for sure. I mean, that gives him the availability to definitely have like 4, 5, 6, 7 all sets. Whereas like if we're looking at it in a much more strict, well-constructed theory lens, you know, maybe he doesn't have fours. Maybe he doesn't have fives. Maybe he only has like one combo of 6-7, if any. But in this particular instance, it's like he's going to have all of them. And to counter that, it's not even just the fear that he has really good hands. It's his availability to bluff, right? He just puts me in a blender. If I bet, you know, 40% or something, and he just check raises pot. Like, what the fuck are we doing moving forward? We're never folding.
Yeah.
But like, are we exact in here?
Yeah, you have no good options at that point.
Yeah.
Because you're not folding and you don't want a flat and getting it all in is horrible.
Yeah, and I mean, it's like, even if we do flat, this becomes like one of the hands that we just ultimately fold later a lot.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Okay, this is really shitty.
Okay, so what was the turn card? It was 8-5-4-2 spades. You had two jacks with the jack. For some reason, I thought you still played preflop, but you didn't. You four bet.
Yeah, thank God Garrett would have won the hand if I had cold called.
Oh, wow.
The turn is an offsuit 10, and Gall chooses a relatively larger size. I think he bet like 75% pot. Pretty good. He has a lot of advantage in this spot, especially versus my checkback range. I just have a very clear bluff catcher. I'm happy to just call twice, almost regardless of runouts. I think that like worst case scenario for me is an ace or a king hitting river, just due to the fact that a lot of his turn bluffs should probably be over cards, with either the backdoor combination or the front door, since flop one check. Like, he just has a lot of availability to be betting equity here.
All right, so it's an offsuit 10 and he leads 75% of pot, which is like 30K or something.
Yeah, roughly.
Okay, and you call, and then what's the river card?
The river put a one-liner out there, so I think it put a one-liner to the six, so it must have been a seven.
So an offsuit seven, though, right?
Yeah, non-spade seven.
And now he puts a shit ton out there.
Yeah. in theory, he's actually just supposed to jam.
Right. How much did he bet? The pot's 100K or so. And he bet like 75K, is that right?
5, yeah. Yeah.
That's so at some point, it's about the absolute amount that's put in the middle as opposed to the percentage of the pot. I mean, maybe not in your mind, but in reality, right? Someone betting 75K is significant, more than them betting 75% of pot. Do you agree with that or disagree?
It depends on the player, I think. I think for like guys that are just built from the simulations, guys like Landon or you know, Jake Schindler, like a lot of these high rollers, it's literally just the math,
right? In this spot, though.
Yeah, they're just detached. But for most live guys, I agree with what you're saying, where there's a certain sensitivity to how much is at risk. I used to talk to Marcus about this a lot. For those who don't know who he is, he's a very successful CEO from Silicon Valley, who came into the high stakes scene. It was like very competitive for quite some time. He plays big bet mix now with Ivy. Like, they'll play like 2K, 4K big bet mix. So the guy's like no joke, but you know, he plays very wide open, similar to like how you and I see the game, where it's just about having wide ranges that try to funnel themselves towards nuts or air and just put in massively large bets. And I kind of caught him scaling his bet sizings down a lot whenever he would go like with a big bet on the turn, get called, and then have like a relatively strong hand on the river. And we spoke about it, and it's just like, yeah, I mean, like, people are just insensitive to certain numbers, or overly sensitive to certain numbers. So yeah. It's like, if $100,000 represents quarter pot, half pot, or 2x pot on the river, that in a lot of people's minds is their threshold to risk. So he's like, you know, sometimes I just have to like get below that threshold, even if it means I'm only betting like third pot. And it does make a lot of sense, because there's like a visceral reaction whenever you see a house get slid out and you have to make an in-game decision.
Yeah, I agree with that a lot. I was going to say there are definitely thresholds. Of course, against Jake Schindler, forget that. He's not thinking about that. He doesn't care about that. But but live players, and even Gall, who's a very experienced live player, so he puts 75, and you don't like it, but you're probably not folding. How long did you take?
I took a while, but really I was just trying to – I mean, I was never folding, which is kind of unfair to Gall, because I did put him through the blender a little bit. I think I tanked for maybe two and a half minutes.
Mm-hmm.
I used a couple time extensions. But the thing is that it's a weirder spot than it should be, because the reason why I'm pure calling or mostly calling is because he just shouldn't have a six. So this board isn't that threatening. But the reason why I have to tank is because I think he could have like 10-7 suited, especially for the size he chose. So like his size almost becomes better than all in, because I don't think he's jamming like two pair for 3x pot.
So an all in is a quicker call, because you can take out the two pairs. You can almost take out sets, because a six makes – you could have a six.
Yeah, like, I could. Possible. I think a set probably just jams. But the whole problem is, yeah, then you start to get into like the circular logic of like, well, what does he think I have? Like, why would he shove a set if the best hand I could have is like one pair?
That's right.
You know, you don't want to go down the rabbit hole too much.
Okay, so you're thinking, you're worried about two pair here. Is your biggest concern?
Yeah, I think so. It was obviously, if he can have 10-7, he can also have a lot of 6x. But I just think he's incentivized to bet bigger with a six. So I was really concerned that like he has a lot of two pair. The other concern is just that it's not very intuitive where his bluffs are coming from. So, you know, I don't know how well constructed he is when he bets turn, bets river here. I don't know that he's going to find like the small pairs for bluffs, or, you know, if he's going to have enough queen jack, that type of shit. So it really is like a no fun spot where your hand doesn't really have a lot of decisions, as far as like all of the hands we could have arrived here with. This is just one of our better ones. But it's very uncomfortable, because it's like, well, do I ever win?
Yeah. Well, and you did call, you did win. What was his hand? Did you ever, I'm sure you watched.
Yeah, he had queen nine of clubs, which is actually like a pretty good double barrel combo. It's a really good one for him to like follow through all in with on the river, I think.
He had queen nine of clubs, and it was, so he picked up a gut shot on the turn?
Yeah. Jack would have been real nightmare for us.
Yeah, that would have been it. But did he pick up a flush draw on the turn or no?
No.
Okay.
That's not a bad thing, because he unblocks me having spades. So like I just have a bunch of auto folds.
Right.
That are similar in strength.
Okay. So that was the hand that I saw that was, I mean, it's a pretty nice pot. You won well over 100K in that hand. Yep. And just from stuff I heard, and I know that if you run hot and have quote unquote easy decisions for those 2 days, people are going to put you on a pedestal. And if you run like garbage and are always in tough spots, they're going to flame you. I'm so aware of that, but it just, even people that I respect a lot with regard to understanding variance, we're saying that you played pretty lights out for those 2 days. Yeah, take it when you can get it, right? Yeah. You've had it go the other way when you're like getting overset and they're like, oh my God, Berkey.
Yeah. That hand gets brought up to me more than any hand I've ever played in my entire life.
Which hand? You got overset by Garrett?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And like, it's never brought up with a grain of like sympathy or anything like that. It's always just like, hey man, you remember that time that Garrett had aces, you had kings, and you both made a set? Brutal.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, thanks.
You flopped the set and he turned a set or something?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's tough, man.
Yeah.
That was a big
flop, which obviously in internet land makes me the worst player on earth.
Of course, because you got stacked in the hand, I assume?
Yeah, it was weird. He ended up betting like, I don't know, like 75% of his stack on the river.
Oh, I saw this.
And I didn't know if I should jam or call. I thought it was like super fucking close. But then I obviously just came to the conclusion like he should have some like ace five, which was two pair.
Yeah.
And, you know, a couple combos of ace king. So I was like, I have to like get the rest versus these hands, otherwise I'm an idiot. And I jammed and he like nit rolled me.
I think he was a little out of sorts.
Sure.
In that hand.
Of course. I mean, yeah. It's like the weird spot.
Yeah, he kinda went in the tank a little bit, and it was just like he was getting 12 billion to 1 on a call with top set.
Yeah, he like immediately apologized, and I didn't think anything.
Yeah, I did see that. It's just giant pots, even someone like that can be out of sorts a little bit at the end. When you jam. I do remember that hand. So it's nice to get a little revenge, not on Garrett as much as just like on stream. Like you just always run garbage. And then for 2 days you go to this new show. A lot of people are watching on those 2 days and those shows are free forever. So people are still watching. They'll go watch after they listen to this. Any other takeaways from those 2 days?
No, honestly, like it was a super fun group. I really enjoyed playing with everybody. It's funny. I heard through the grapevine that Krish thinks I'm a nit, which I think is hilarious, but it makes sense. I kind of just like held over him for 2 days.
Mm-hmm.
Like I had value. He had worse value. Or if he was trying to bluff, I just found my way into a call. So it's easy to like give the wrong impression. I just think it's funny when people classify me as nit. It's like you were like one in a million. Actually,
think yeah. Yeah, you don't hear Berkey's a nit too often. But also, and this is what I try and explain to people, is that I don't think people who are quote-unquote lags choose to be lags or that's their personality. I think they just see it as the best way to make money in the majority of lineups. And sometimes the lineup calls for, damn, I just need to play solid right now because that's the best way to play poker.
Yeah.
And I'm terrible at shifting into that, but it sounds like you did for a couple of days, and it was just
I did rocket it off with Jack 9 high.
Oh, you did? Nice. Yeah. Can you give us a quick recap of that one? People love Hand of Histories, as you know.
Yeah. So this was against Dylan Gang,
who
was to my left both days, and anytime I entered a pot, he only 3-bet or fold. So he played zero call versus me, which is relevant to this hand. So Lucky opens, who is a very special player, to say the least.
Yep.
And he opened big. He opened like 5x or something silly. But, you know, whatever. He just does a bunch of random shit.
You used to open 5x, man.
Yeah. I think there's a reason to do it, for sure. But he'll just do it at random.
Right, okay. Right?
Like, he'll go from opening like 2.5 to just like one random spot. He'll open like 5x and show.
Sure. Suited. Yeah.
So he opens 5x from the low jack, I think. I was in the hijack with Jack 9 of hearts, and we were very deep. We were like, I think we were like 250 effective playing 2-4. So like 600 blinds. I 3-bet to, so he opened 2K. I 3-bet to 5K. Dylan then cold 4-bets to 15,000, which his sizings tended to be larger. So when he was 3-betting me before, it was usually greater than 3x. And for a 4-bet size, like this is definitely appropriate. I just kind of expected him to miss size for whatever that's worth when he had good hands. In any event, I'm getting a good price. We're super deep. I call. and the board comes, let me get this right. I flop a double gutty. So it must have been
5-7-8.
5-7-8. Yes. 100% 5-7-8. 5-7-8, one of my suit, and I believe it was two diamonds on the flop.
Man, how are you gonna lose this hand? You just shouldn't lose this hand.
Actually, it might have been none of my suit. So I think it was like two diamonds, two spades. Or sorry, two diamonds, one spade.
Okay.
I check. He continuation bets for a very strange size. I want to say he bet something like 40 to 60% pot. Like, just it's probably fine. But it just felt intuitively off because I would expect him to be checking this board a fair amount of the time.
Right. He just bet like 15 again.
Yeah, maybe he bet like 18-ish, something along those lines. It was something like a little bit weird where I would have expected him to either go bigger or just check.
Right.
And he just looked like he wanted to die also, like the entire hand. So I was already determined at this point. It was like, okay, I obviously have too much equity to fold, but also I'm going to fucking win this hand.
Yeah.
Improved or not, right? Or right. Improved or not. So I call, and the turn is the three of the backdoor cards. So now I think it's two spades, two diamonds, and I have jack nine of hearts. I check, and he very shakily puts out like 35K, which I think was somewhere in the neighborhood of like 60% pot. And now SPR is like two, give or take. So in theory, I don't really think we have many jams in given like the stack to pot ratio that we have. But in practice, this guy doesn't fucking have a hand. Like, that's just what I've arrived at. It's very clear he just does not have a hand, and I can't call. So there's only really one option left in the book as far as
this I'm just concerned. Sucks when he calls because he has a flush draw and he has a better high card.
Oh my, no, because like there's just no way he could do this with a I mean, sure, there's a way. It's just like such a mistake.
Yeah.
To use these sizings.
Right.
Like, he'd either be checking or betting bigger if he had more equity than me. Let's put it that way.
Okay.
At least that's my perception anyway. So yeah, I really felt like if I waited, it's the first time I've ever used a time card with a street left to play. Mm. Like, I've never tanked on flop or turn before facing a bet.
Right.
You know, you just kind of have an idea of what you're supposed to do. And then when you get to the river, you want to feel some things out, whatever. But I just wanted to make sure that he actually might die. And so I used the time card. And over that minute, I actually thought that there was a chance we're going to have to call paramedics because he stopped breathing.
Wow. So you're just like, torturing him?
Yeah. I put him through the ringer. I rip it in. And he very quickly folds the queen nine.
Okay. Very nice.
Yeah. Best case scenario, he had me fucking dead.
Yeah. Have you played with him a bunch?
No, I knew him previously. He bought action from like a bunch of high rollers and we had spoken a bunch on Instagram, but that was the first time I actually got to play with him.
Okay. Why was he, what was the story? Why was he just three bet or fold to all your opens?
I'm not sure. I mean, he's a ton of action, which is great, but it also, from best I could tell, it seems like he tries.
Oh, he definitely tries.
Yeah. Well, let me rephrase this.
He definitely makes money playing poker. I promise you that.
Yeah. It seems like he's somewhat studied.
Yeah.
In the most simplistic version of study, right? So it's like he probably has pretty good understanding of simplified strategy. So playing three better fold, choosing a one size flop strategy, that type of stuff. So like, yeah, I didn't discredit him at all. But the problem is when you're limited to those simple actions, what it does is it really handcuffs you to playing tight, and no part of Dylan wants to play tight, right? So
right.
If he only has a four better fold range, like if he's not allowed to cold call my three bet, which happens live all the fucking time, then all of a sudden, like, he has to start folding queen nine suited and he doesn't want to. So now he just four bets way too many hands.
Interesting. Yeah. I just wondered if it was some like personal vendetta, like you guys battle all the time and no, you've been getting the best of him. Oh, he was buried too.
Yeah.
You keep mentioning this, the game flow, these two big pots or these two important hands that both your opponents were buried and you were able to pick off you know, over 100K in bluff in total. And then the other one, not only did you pick it off, but you actually bluffed him out before the river came. So you still, as much as you're into the theory these days, you're still about that live stuff a little bit, the game yeah. flow and all that.
I still, to this day, I think it holds way more value to the average live player than, well, that's not fair because that's very dismissive of theory. I just think it adds a lot to your win rate if you're good at it. Let's put it that way. Mainly because your opponents aren't very studied. So when they are not emotionally invested and very even keeled and not triggered in any way, shape, or form, they're just they're significantly less likely to take risks. So that's why in these live environments, like, you just find yourself calling with a natural bluff catcher that's supposed to call all the fucking time, and you always get shown the nuts. It's like, yeah, well, you're playing against a guy who's up, who has no interest in trying to figure out what he's supposed to bluff, and he's just playing sound as far as, like, he's concerned with regards to poker strategy. But, like, you know, you get him stuck a couple buy-ins.
You're playing against a different range. Yeah. You're playing against entirely different range.
Right.
Exactly. He's three-betting Garrett in the previous hand. Gallus three-betting Garrett with some sort of range in general, a different range when he's up a ton, and a different range when he's buried. And that's just pretty basic. And it's pretty cool. You were able to, I mean, you had one pair in one of the hands and you had Jack high in the other hand. You had really, really nice pots. But you had fun playing with everyone. You play with Ivy a bunch, I'm sure. And oh, you never had?
That was the first time I ever played with him.
Oh, really? Interesting. Yeah. How about Durr?
I played with Durr a fair amount.
Yeah.
Durr actually, so we played a lot. We played a lot during my big downswing in 2015.
Mm-hmm.
So there was like a 4-month stretch probably from like spring of 2015 into the summer where I just lost every fucking session. And because I was losing every session, I was getting invited every session.
Yeah.
And this was when a lot of the guys from Macau were in town. So the game was playing massive and I was getting wrecked. And I was playing a lot of shorthanded games that included Durr. And we have a mutual friend in David Benefield. And at the time he told Benefield that he's never seen a crazier preflop player than me, which.
Wow. Durr's saying that about you.
Right. It's like, that's the joke, right? Like that's the fucking joke.
Oh my God.
Man. Like, hey, what happened?
That's pretty amazing, man. The Tom Dwan said he's never seen a crazier preflop player than you.
Yeah. Like, it's like, thinking back, I took a bunch of notes during those sessions too, because I was just like losing my mind. And I look at them now and it's like, yeah, I was definitely playing badly. But preflop was like the least of my concerns. It was like, yeah, I was opening like ace nine off from the low jack instead of, you know, the cutoff. But
right.
Whatever, like I was playing against businessmen.
Yeah. Oh, okay. That's pretty funny, man. That's when you can, I don't know. It's at some point you gotta document that this guy who still plays extremely wide and aggressive preflop. He just came back on Hustler Casino Live and I was commentating and he was up to his old trick. So it's a little surprising. What also is kind of interesting is it was a similar lineup. Krish was there and Dylan was in the game. And as a commentator, I was just saying, all these guys are brick walls. You can't get anything through against any of them. Whoever has the best hand wins. And the obvious adjustment in a lineup like that, in a game like that, is to just kind of play solid and kind of play decent hands. And that's where the money is. And you kind of alluded to that. And that's funny. You got called a nit when you were running hot and you were, yeah. You got called the craziest player ever when you were downswinging.
Yeah. That's the human perception, right? Like we want to see what we want to see and we want everything to make sense. So we tell the story backwards. We look at the result and then we say, okay, what's the most logical story that makes sense to lead to this result?
And right.
So if you're getting whacked, then this guy fucking sucks.
Yep.
And he can make all of these adjustments that I already made in my game and I'm way better than him because of it. And when he's winning, it's just like, oh, yeah, he did this, that, or the other, which was the sickest thing in the world, and no one else could do it. It's like, okay, or neither, right. You know?
Yeah. So I want to go from, well, first of all, was this good for, this had to be good for business. You just crushing all these legends of poker on stream, bunch of people watching. Was it good for Solve for Why, or did you see anything from that?
It's so tough to measure. The training sphere is very, it's shifting. It's shifting very hard, I think. And I think like in the next 6 to 12 months, we're going to see a pretty hard divide between like serious training and more casual training blended with entertainment, if that makes some sense. And I think it's very, yeah, I think it's very similar to like what we see in the fitness industry. There is a very small percentage of personal trainers who are training fitness athletes that are either trying to prepare for, you know, like an Ironman or some serious competition, or they're trying to get like stage ready through bodybuilding. And the vast majority of those trainers are elite in their field. They are either kinesiologists or they are biologists who understand body chemistry very well, whatever the case may be. Basically, they're giving that last 1% to somebody who's already very elite at what they do. And then the rest of trainers are just people who are more educated and more regimented and disciplined than the average person. And they're just trying to help be a guiding hand to get that person from sloth to somebody who makes it to the gym a few times a week, lives a healthier lifestyle, eats better, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, right? I think poker is going very much in the same direction in the sense that there are so many resources available to teach yourself if you actually have a high enough ceiling where you can become elite. But it's also worth noting that the amount of people that are capable of reaching that ceiling is very, very small. It's like maybe 1-2% of people who ever enter this game. So though there is a ton of technology being developed, these GTO trainers, I wanted to lump them both together, but yeah, like basically GTO trainers where you can train against your solutions and see what happens at equilibrium. Solvers are advancing, you know, preflop solvers, range constructors, things of that nature. All these are very important, and the elite are certainly utilizing them. But they can also just be like pretty self-sustaining and don't really need much outside of the tech. For the vast majority of people who play poker and have an interest in getting better, that's not their ceiling. Their ceiling is to like play in their game and not lose. Their ceiling is to like beat the rake. Their ceiling is to supplement their income and maybe make, 50% of what they acquire from their actual career. And because that's true, there is a huge divide between how I learn the game and how I have to teach the game.
Right.
So yeah, like things like Hustler Stream is great because I guess it gives me some credibility as a person who can beat high stakes. But again, it's with that large collective that really doesn't understand elite poker and probably never really will. I don't think that there's anything that you can do to fall in good favor amongst those who are capable of beating the game at the highest levels, because there's just way too much bravado involved and nothing passes the sniff test, right? I hear people that are like in the high stakes arena criticizing Adamo right now, basically saying like, oh, he's just a fish on a heater and like these things that he's doing are so unsound. There's no open-mindedness to the idea that anybody's working hard enough that they could be ahead of the curve.
And right.
Because that's true, poker will always thrive to some degree until, you know, the singularity occurs and we all have Google glasses hardwired into our brain and can just see the solutions, right? But yeah, I mean, I think that like, I know that you've always been very anti-training and I don't necessarily disagree, but I do think that it's gotten to a point now where training actually is propping up the ecosystem in a very big way.
Yeah, I agree with that. In addition, you're saying some entertainment in addition to strategy. And also there's a ton of community. Like a lot of people really love when they go to your, what do you call it? Your is it called boot camp?
Or is it, it's an academy.
an academy. When they go to that, I know people who have gone to it and they really get a lot out of it. They're not going to go play a high roller anytime soon. They're not going to be walking into Ivy's room or Bobby's room, but they are going to take their favorite hobby and it's going to become, if it's been a big leak, it's going to become less of a leak, maybe break even, maybe start to win. I think that's what you're talking about. And so we talked about when someone wins, the perception is they're the best. You played against all these guys that are quote unquote the best. Of course, you and I know Tom Dwan and Phil Ivey are not the best at No Limit Hold'em by any stretch right now, but the perception is they are.
Sure.
And you played people, like, I don't think anyone played better than you on stream those 2 days, and you won a bunch and everything worked out well. And so I was thinking that the perception is, okay, Berkey just crushed everyone. He's the best right now. I just was wondering if a lot of people will say, okay, now I'm going to solve for why I want to be a part of this. But you can't measure it. It's too hard to tell.
It's tough to know. I would make a strong argument that Garrett actually played as well, if not better than me, despite the fact he got his head kicked in.
Yeah.
I thought he played like remarkably disciplined, considering like how shitty his distribution was. But yeah, with regard to like it acquiring new eyes to us, it's possible. In my experience, having run this company now for 6 years, almost everybody who comes our way is much more invested in the sense of community. Like they believe way more in just the overall methodology behind how we're studying and the lens through which we're looking at this game. But more importantly, just like the idea that a bunch of like-minded people can still enjoy poker and not suck all the fun out of it by just bombarding you with a bunch of minuscule river decisions that you're never actually going to execute correctly in real time.
Right. Yeah, I was for a very long time totally anti-training site, but I try not to think in black and white at all anymore. And I do agree with you that aside from the initial, the real blow that poker took was when everyone started three betting, when all the money started going in early as opposed to late. Yeah. That was, but that's already done. And so I do agree that it does get people to, it gives them some confidence to play in bigger games, which is good. And I guess if they're not getting whacked as much, that's good for the games. So I'm not anti anymore, but
it's just very special. I think I think it's just so protected. So like I do think your point is valid with what we've seen online. I think that whether it's training sites or just the advent of stronger technology, it's all but wiped out the mid and high stakes arena online. And the reason for that is just largely the ability to apply at volume, right? So if you get very proficient, whether you're running RTA or you're able to actually just execute comparable strategies to RTA on your own, and you could do so over mass volume, millions of hands, well, now the stakes don't really matter too much. And people who are that good will play like a range of maybe $500 cap all the way up to like 10K cap. And you just don't see that live because you can't put in the volume, right? So the 10, 20 games and below are so insanely protected. And they always will be. And that's why I think that, like I said, the training is kind of propping up the industry, because what's actually happening is really all the training sites in one way or another are just giving basic guidelines for people to think about whenever they are in game. And what that's doing now is reining in a little bit of the egregious errors that people are prone to making whenever they just don't think about the game in any way, shape, or form. So to your point, when the money used to just all go in a lot later in hands, the bad players are making mistakes that are, you know, maybe minus 100 big blinds in any one particular spot. And that's hard to do if you're only like maybe 200 big blinds deep. But basically, they're just like putting in a bunch of fucking money stone dead.
Right.
In spots where, you know, the pot's very big. But like what these heuristics will help with is making them understand, you know, not to overplay one pair in a single raise pot when the SPR is 20, right? Like it's just not okay to face a check raise on like 7-3 deuce and just smash all in with aces.
Right. Going back to your Jackson, it wouldn't be okay to be betting there. Gall raises and you're just like overpair bitch all in.
Yeah. The more extreme example, right, is like a 3-bet pot where the SPR is still deep, like 10 plus or whatever, and it comes 4-5-6. And you know, you just always had that old man back in the day that would just punt off a stack there. Where you're just like, I have aces, I don't know what to do, don't want to see another card, I'm all in.
Right.
It's just like, okay, still flop the set, still flop the straight.
Right.
And you just get a gift. So yeah, that's kind of fallen away. And that's not a bad thing. Right, it makes the game a lot more competitive. It makes it so that you're shearing the sheep instead of skinning them.
Of course, which
I think is good for the ecosystem as a whole.
Yeah, I think it's good as a whole that there's less of a gap. And of course, the other thing that's been most frustrating to me personally is that people learned to just not fold after the flop. That it's just like, oh well. Yeah, I shouldn't overplay my pair, but I also shouldn't fold it either. Not yet. And but those changes have already happened. And I agree with you that they are propping along with other content and vlogs and all that are propping the game up at this time.
They're not folding so brutal, man. Like,
yeah, you're telling me, man.
like now, I mean, like thinking back to like when we were coming up,
yeah,
we were thought of as sticky.
Yep.
Because we'd stick around facing a flop bet with like bottom pair or a gut shot, you know, it's like we always had that hidden hand or whatever. And now it's just like, oh yeah, you were just right to do that.
And you know what? That was the same. The grinders back then would say fish on a heater too at that same stuff. And then fast forward a few years and now, oh no, that's what you need to be doing for several different reasons. So that's cool. That was a cool recap of Hustler Casino Live and a cool little training site discussion. What sparked this interview is I took my kids out to see my dad in Phoenix, and I stopped in Yuma at McDonald's and got my kids some food, and I took a picture of the Yuma water tank or whatever it is. And you saw it on Twitter, and you said, I have a good story from when I was broke and trying to make, I think you said, independent league, some baseball team, the independent league. Yeah. And I think you told this, you might have told this story when I interviewed you a year and a half ago, or maybe I just know it, but I know that people are going to enjoy it. So let's turn back time. How many years are we going back to you being in Yuma?
So this was in 2007.
Shortly before I ever met you, I think.
Yeah, the year before I moved to Vegas.
2007.
So it was January 2007.
Okay, and you're clinging to this childhood dream of being a professional baseball player.
Yeah, so at this point, I would be 2 years removed from college ball. And this was like a Hail Mary, a last-ditch effort to get signed. By baseball standards, I was just old at this point. I was like 24, maybe 25. I think that there were like 100 people invited to this camp, and I was one of the 5 oldest. So to give you an idea, Sergio Romo was one of my roommates, and he was
relief pitcher.
Yeah, he was 19 at the time, freshly signed by the Giants in rookie ball. So he was just there to get in like a winter workout, and I was the grizzled old man at 24. Ironically, we threw the same speed, but he was just, you know, fucking nasty. And yeah, I had signed up for it. So 2006 was very good to me. I played my first World Series, satellited in through Party Poker, had a lot of online success. And by the end of the year, I had like 60 or 70,000, which was the most I had ever had. But late in December, to backtrack, I'd signed up for this, or I'd agreed to go to this winter camp, and it cost like $1,500 to cover like travel, living expense. We were there for 35 days, I think. Well, fast forward now to the end of December, and I just I was a DJ and very much so back then. Like, I chased losses bad. And I played a lot of like heads up PLO, and I started playing like 2-4 or maybe 5-10. But before it was all said and done, I was like 8 tabling 25-50 against people who knew what they were doing, and I was fucking clueless. So I torched my role. By the time I got to this winter camp, I had like 8K left of the 60. Didn't know what the fuck I was going to do. And it just so happened that the only weekend we had off for the 6 weeks that we were there was my birthday weekend, which is January 29th. And it also just so happened that Paradise Casino, which borders Yuma, Arizona, and California, it literally has like a painted line going through the casino, had no limit for the first time because they moved the poker room to the California side.
Oh, wow. So
previously, it was on the Arizona side.
Spread limit.
Spread limit, yeah. So they moved it to the California side, allowing for no limit. And they had a 3-5 game that only ran on Wednesdays that was a $700 cap, I think, which I had been playing pretty routinely and doing okay. Again, I had like very little money, so I was maybe making like a few $100, maybe up like a couple thousand at that point. But this Saturday, that was my birthday, that we had off, strangely enough, they ran their first ever No Limit Hold'em tournament. And it might have been the only one that's ever ran. But they guaranteed 20K to first place. It was a $500 buy-in with an optional $500 rebuy or add-on, your choice. So you could either take it up front or you could wait till the add-on period or whatever. I took it up front, and when it was all said and done, only six people had either rebought or added on.
Wow.
So they guaranteed 20K to first. They ended up only getting 100 people total. So the total prize pool was like 50K. Now 40% of which is up top. And by some grace of God, I just went wire to wire in this thing and never looked back.
Sick.
So I just rip off 20K. I have this stupid, I still have it. I don't know how I still have it, but I have this stupid bracelet that they gave me. Paradise Casino.
That thing's sweet, man.
Yeah, 2007. We got it. I don't know what the fuck it's worth. I should have pawned it a long time ago. But yeah, I ended up, so they signed like 20 people, 20 kids out of this camp. I ended up not being one of them, but I had a working role again. Went back home, grinded, got all the money back, moved to Vegas. Rest is history.
Wow. So it's called Paradise Casino, and there's a line going through the middle of the casino, and half is on Arizona and half is California. Is there a prison right there too?
Possibly. I didn't do very much exploring, to be honest.
Yeah.
And honestly, the casino may not even exist anymore.
Yeah. I didn't see it when I was driving through. That's cool that you've had a lot of tournament success, but that one sounds kind of like the most memorable, I bet, just going wire to wire.
It was meaningful. It felt like very, like I felt very chosen in the moment.
That's also awesome.
I can't believe I didn't get robbed. I went to practice on Monday. So I'm like living in a hotel. I don't have a safe or anything. I just have like 20K cash on me. And I went to practice on Monday, and like word had spread through the teams that I won this tournament. I like have my bracelet there to show off to the coaches and everything. And I can't believe somebody didn't just like bust into my hotel room and just snatch it all.
Yeah, that would not have been surprising at all.
Oh, yeah, definitely not.
So pretty cool to hear. And that was 2007, and then you moved to Vegas in 2008.
Yeah, January 2008.
January 2008. So just about exactly a year after that, yep. That bink in Yuma, Arizona, and then I met you. Probably I moved there in, I think, June of 2008, and then we started battling. So it's cool to see you're crushing in 2021, and you go back just 14 years ago, and you really needed to bink, and you did. And then we have a few questions that people. I said we're going to do this on Twitter, and we got some joke questions and some real ones. Let's start with one of the joke questions because it's from Adam Johnson. Do you know Adam Johnson? Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. He asked what was in your thermos back in the day. You always had a giant thermos with you at the poker table. And he wants to know because he says that it seems to have worked.
Well, I had to, I would always bring a gallon of water with me, but the food that I packed was like this homemade chili that I would make. It's like super, super, it, honestly, calling it chili is probably an insult to chili. It's literally just ground meat, kidney beans, and tomato soup.
Okay, but in your thermos was always just water.
Yeah. If it was like the gallon jug that I had, yeah, it was just water.
Have you still never had a drink in your life or a beer?
Never a sip.
Wow. And you never smoked weed or anything?
No.
Wow, that's pretty strong. Okay. So that was from Adam. So I figured I would ask you that. And then people want to know about your vlogcast. What's the story with that? What's the status?
I'm not sure, man. There are a lot of fucking podcasts out there. I'm not sure if you're aware.
I know there are a bunch. Yeah.
I don't know. I really enjoy it. I enjoyed it a lot. It's just, I don't know how to make it so that it both feels genuine and interesting. I kind of have this idea of just like doing it with all my friends. So just kind of like rebuilding the set. I mean, we have so much space and we have so much available production here that I do want to do something different. I kind of like the idea of just like, you know, getting everybody who's involved in the company in one way, shape, or form or another, and just like sitting down and doing like a 1 hour pod weekly. But I haven't really fleshed it out yet. I don't know how it all makes sense. And also, like, I just don't know. I don't know. You never know what you're going to get, right? Like, if we just fire off, who knows if people are going to be interested? Like, at the end of the day, this is what I really struggle with, is who the fuck wants to listen to a poker player talk about anything that isn't poker? And the last thing that I want to talk about is poker.
Yeah. I've tricked people into listening to me talk about youth sports and stuff like that, but it's not easy. That's very fair. You guys have a solve for why compound out there in Vegas. That's pretty cool. I do know what definitely works is the poker out loud. People, and I'm sure you know that, the feedback you get on that, and I'm sure you have measurements as well. They've got to be really good, right?
Yeah, I mean, I'm doing my damnedest to just like basically lean into Poker Out Loud as much as possible as far as our product goes. If I could, I would just totally saturate everything we do with that type of content. It's just hard because it's high production value, so it takes a lot to actually get a season filmed. And also, you know, you have to find willing participants, which is tough because the days are super long and we pay everybody, but like, it's not like we're giving them thousands of dollars to come and give us 8 hours of their time. But one thing that we're going to be doing moving into this year is we're going to change the structure of the academy. Before, it was just 3 days where we would split the day between theory discussion in the morning and gameplay in the afternoon, where we would do commentary and kind of point out mistakes and the things that everybody does well. Instead, we are going to do it where the days alternate between theory discussion and play, and the actual gameplay itself will just be Poker Out Loud version. So I think it gives a much greater experience for those who are kind of serious about learning. It's one thing to actually be thinking in real time. It's another to acknowledge that you have to think because you have to say something.
Yeah. You were talking, well, you said that training sites are part strategy, part entertainment. And someone like myself, I have not much interest in what some of these players are going to be doing in their hands pre-flop or whatever. But I find that show entertaining as well, depending who the person is. I think that's exactly what you were talking about. Something that can help a lot of people get better and also entertain the masses, and the production value is amazing. So that's cool. You're combining your academy with that, and you're going to get more content out of that.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll definitely be able to do a lot more with it. And yeah, I agree with you. Like, I think one thing that poker really lacks is a dynamic element that engages people, right? Like, at the end of the day, there's nothing moving. It's not like watching a video game where, you know, there's something around the corner that you have to fear, or something exciting happens in sport where this is what you've been anticipating, right? It's just cards being dealt face down, people making mental decisions, and us having to speculate based on why they did what they did. When you remove the level of speculation, now the viewer kind of gets to engage, where you kind of get to have a debate with the person playing the hand, right? Where it's like, when you hear somebody talk and say like, okay, I'm going to do this for all of these reasons, and you, the viewer, feel like you're more knowledgeable than them. Well, now you can kind of just be like, no, you're wrong, and this is exactly why.
Right. Yeah. I look forward to more of those. Someone showed me one of them one time, and I thought it was just like really interesting. Yeah, I don't know. So I think that'll work. Any other plans for 2022? Any big plans or?
I want to personally like take a bigger step back from the actual content creation side, and kind of leave it up to the team. So I'm doing my due diligence right now to kind of curate a good cast of coaches that can fill the void. I'll still be doing my part, but I want to do a lot less of it, because I'd like to focus on like the business development side, and more importantly, kind of find whatever lateral movements there are into other industries. I love poker to death, and I don't want to go anywhere anytime soon, but it's just so limiting, right? Like, it's not a growing marketplace. It's definitely a dying one. And that's problematic if you own and operate a business within it. But with that said, I think that like poker is probably one of the greatest sandboxes for life. So you just get to play around and learn so much about complex, chaotic systems that we kind of take for granted in everyday life. You know, like, poker and life aren't that much different. There's EV attached to every single decision that we make, and we just don't really think that way, or it's too exhausting to think that way, I guess. But when you can start to shift into more of a probabilistic mindset and start to view life through those lenses, I do think that there's kind of an unlocking phase that takes place where you can kind of elevate yourself in a lot of ways. And for those reasons, I think that poker players in particular are like very qualified to move into a lot of other spaces and demonstrate maybe higher ceilings and pathways to achieving them that those who have been in the space for long periods of time just overlook, because they're kind of numb to it all.
Yeah. I think you said when I interviewed you a while back that when you started Solve for Why, you knew it was going to be for poker players and about poker strategy at the beginning, but you wanted it to be something beyond that from the jump, right?
Yeah. I mean, the whole framework of it is just how to be more logical in our decision-making process, how to think through problems in real time, and you know, kind of use rational thought to do so. So that applies everywhere. And I think that the easier of a transition we find into a bigger space, the more scale will be potentially available for something like this. You know, even 6 years in, it's still a little bit unclear, because a lot of what we're still doing is just creating how-to videos. And the more technology advances, the less important that's going to be, no matter what space you're in. But I don't think it's beyond the realm of possibility that we just stumble into another industry where our certain skill set allows us to start developing like higher levels of technology.
Cool. It sounds like we might start to see that transition or growth, whatever you want to call it, in 2022. Appreciate you coming on, man. Thanks for the hour. Anything else you want to say? You want to give any shout outs to anyone out there or anything like that?
No, Merry Christmas to everybody. I guess it's just, I don't know. I always feel like, I'm not outwardly thankful enough of, everybody who's in my life and everybody who kind of like touched my life along the way and helped propel me to the situation that I'm in. But also I feel like none of them are listening to these podcasts anyway. So
they listen, like, man. They listen.
No. The hardcores listen. And yeah, for them, those are the ones that, like I want to curate the message for them. Right. So whether it's a story of days of old or, a hand history where we're putting in a house, that's for them, you know?
Yep. All right, man. Merry Christmas. Thanks a lot for doing this, and don't be a stranger.
Yeah, never. Thanks for having me on.
All right, cool.
I hope you all enjoyed the Sessions Christmas special with Berkey. Happy holidays to all of you, regardless of what you celebrate or don't celebrate. And if you're wondering why I was so loud and Berkey was not as loud, it's because my sound guy is a drunk pervert. Peace. I hope you enjoyed this drop of Sessions. If you are a patron, thank you. And if you're not a patron, well, I don't know what to tell you. Huh? Princess, I'm doing the outro. That's a lot of stuff. Princess, I know, we're trying. Larger than life. I guess I'm gonna need some help then. Princess, I hope the listeners go to patreon.com/DGAF poker player. Cause otherwise,